Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 910, The Killer Bees, The Belgian Muslim Brotherhood and the Brussels Bombings, subtitled The ISIS File Part 2. This is being recorded on May 22nd of the year 2016. On this past several days, an Egypt airplane went down apparently as the result of terrorism. Among the directions being taken by the investigation itself, or among the focal points, is an apparent cell at the airport in France, Orly Airport, that has links to individuals or elements that were associated with some of the ISIS attacks in France. We have noted in many, many programs that the support by transnational corporations and their allied political and national security elites is not unlike the support for the Axis powers of Europe during World War II, because of the corporatist economics philosophy, the anti-labor and anti-communist philosophy of fascism. It was viewed with great favor by the transnational corporations and still is. The dominant Islamist group, the parent organization, certainly, of Al-Qaeda, of the various Al-Qaeda-associated elements, such as the Al-Nusra Front and others, the parent organization of Hamas, which, along with Palestinian Islamic Jihad, is the Brotherhood offshoot in Palestine, and apparently also ISIS group and related organizations. The Muslim Brotherhood appears to be the parent of those groups. The founder of ISIS was a, quote, ex-unquote member of the Muslim Brotherhood, no doubt becoming ex, when he came out as the leader of ISIS, one of the things that does not apparently occur to Western observers is that the Islamists have learned the tactic of plausible deniability, and they know how to do it. What we're going to be looking at in this program concerns not only some evidentiary tributaries running between the Belgium Islamist milieu and the Muslim Brotherhood and the elements that appear to be associated with various attacks in Belgium, and also some frightening moves apparently in the direction of Belgium's nuclear facilities, but also the way in which those elements are inextricably linked with the continued use of Sunni jihadists, including Al-Qaeda and ISIS-connected elements, in order to, among other things, destabilize and remove Bashar al-Assad's regime in Syria. Other elements are being used against Russia in the Caucasus, and even now against Russia and ethnic Russians in Ukraine. We'll be dealing with that at greater length in our next program. One of the things that may be confusing to some listeners is, well, how can the transnational corporations and their associated political and the national security elites be supporting the Muslim Brotherhood spin-offs like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, when at the same time we are engaged in combat to an extent against some of those same elements? Well, again, World War II, I think, is the instructive consideration. It was a very real war, and there was a great deal of bloodshed on the part of Allied fighting men and women, and yet the transnational corporations were very supportive of the rise of fascism and saw to it that in Germany, and as we saw in our last, in For the Record 905, Japan and also Italy, as well as other places. Fascism was simply returned to power after the war, again, because of its corporatist economic agenda, its anti-communist and anti-labor orientation. For the record, 731, we visited once again with John Loftus, and we took a look at his latest published book, which is America's Nazi Secret. And he related, we've talked about the corporate support for fascism by American industrialists and financiers and corporations. One of the most striking elements talked about by John Loftus was an American banker associated with Chase Manhattan, or then the Chase Bank. He was captured by Allied troops, by American troops, and along with some 100 other functionaries of American corporations, had been in Germany during the entire course of World War II, helping to manage U.S.-connected transnational corporations, subsidiaries in Germany, as it contributed in a material way to the German war effort. And when a sentry guarding him opined that the Chase Bank might not even want to know about this guy, he said, well, no, I think they will see to it that I get off. And he was right, even though he was, frankly, a traitor and had collaborated with the Third Reich against this country and its fighting men and women, he got off. That is, I think, altogether instructive. What we're going to begin with is a look at the guy named Bassem, B-A-S-S-E-M, last name Hattahep, H-A-T-T-A-H-E-T. He is arguably the most important Belgian Muslim Brotherhood figure. He is originally from Syria. He has links to the Bank al-Taqwa milieu and has been engaged in combat against Bashar al-Assad in Syria on the part of the Western-backed coalition. We have talked about Youssef Nada, the former German intelligence officer, head of the Bank al-Taqwa, which had an unlimited account, an account with unlimited credit for al-Qaeda. The driving force behind Bank al-Taqwa was François Genoux, heir to the political last will and testament and collected literary works of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. There are profound links between the Bank al-Taqwa milieu and the Islamic Free Market Institute set up by Grover Norquist with an assist from Karl Rove. And the operating director of that was a guy named Talat Osman, who had been the director of George W. Bush's Arbusto Energy, and in that regard had been shepherded into that position by a guy named Gait Tharoun of the BCCI. We talked about this in, for the record, 356. The Muslim Brotherhood links of the Islamic Free Market Institute, reflecting the corporatist orientation of the Muslim Brotherhood, have profound links to the GOP, to its ethnic outreach milieu, and to the George W. Bush administration. Indeed, the al-Taqwa milieu and the Muslim Brotherhood enjoy very deep and broad-based support in this country. And sadly, under the Obama administration, much of that support has been continued. One of the things that we have spoken about in the past concerns, we've looked at this in a big way in connection with JFK's assassination. The intelligence services and the military basically run American foreign and national security policy. The president affects those, but he does not control it. And when a president goes against the will of the intelligence services, CIA in particular, and the military, he is removed or destabilized, whether it is altogether violently, as with JFK, or whether he is destabilized by covert operation, as Jimmy Carter was. The fact of the matter is, the president does not, in the end, call the shots. And indeed, the support for the Al-Taqwa Operation Green Quest Muslim Brotherhood milieu has continued. But for a point of departure in our understanding of what is going on or what has been going on in Belgium, we're going to begin with a post from the Global Muslim Brotherhood Daily Watch from April 14th of 2008. This is the Global Muslim Brotherhood Daily Watch feeds along the lower right-hand portion of the front page of the Spitfire List website. This is called The Muslim Brotherhood in Belgium by Steve Merley, M-E-R-L-E-Y. It begins, a 2002 report by the Intelligence Committee of the Belgian Parliament explained how the Brotherhood operates in Belgium. And skipping down. A January 2007 article on the Internet describes a Bassem, B-A-S-S-E-M, Hatahet, H-A-T-A-H-E-T, as a member of the FIOE, a Muslim Brotherhood affiliate in Belgium. He is 43 years old and was born in Damascus, Syria, where he still likely has relatives. Various sources list a residential address for Mr. Hatahet in northwest central Brussels. Security sources in Belgium describe Mr. Hatahet as the most important Muslim Brotherhood figure in Belgium, and a Bassem Hatahet was listed in a 1999 phone book belonging to Youssef Nada, a self-described leader of the Muslim Brotherhood who was designated by the U.S. in 2002 as a terrorism financier. And skipping down. This would appear to confirm Mr. Hatahet's role as the most important figure in the Belgian Brotherhood as reported by the Belgian Security Services. And of the FEMYSO that he is linked with, founded in 1996 and headquartered in Brussels, FEMYSO is a youth and student division of FIOE and will be discussed later in this report, and still later. Hadia, H-A-D-I-A, Himat, H-I-M-M-A-T, is the former FEMYSO vice president and likely the daughter of Ali Galeb Himat, longtime head of the IGB, and Mr. El Zayat's predecessor and a close associate of Youssef Nada, the foreign minister, unquote, for the International Muslim Brotherhood, and also a former member of the IGB. Nada, recall, appears to have been working as an agent of the Abwehr, German intel, during World War II. He, according to an article in the Asia Times that we accessed in For the Record 416, actually assisted the escape of Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, from a French prison to the Middle East at the end of World War II. Now again, the apparent most important Muslim Brotherhood figure in Belgium is the aforementioned Bassem, B-A-S-S-E-M, Hatahet, H-A-T-A-H-E-T. He is linked to Youssef Nada and Ali Galeb, or the daughter of Ali Galeb Himat. Again, key members of the Muslim Brotherhood of the Al-Taqwa / Al-Qaeda milieu, and inextricably linked with the figures and institutions which in turn are inextricably linked to the GOP, the George W. Bush administration, and that were targeted by the March 20th, 2002 Operation Green Quest raids.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
We have looked in the past in some of our discussions, such as the discussion in For the Record 880, at how the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood is among the organizations that has received clandestine CIA and other Western intel support for the effort against Syrian President Assad. Bassem Hatahet appears to be part of that effort. This again from Global Muslim Brotherhood Daily Watch of September 18th of 2012. Muslim Brotherhood affiliation of Belgian Brotherhood leader confirmed. The website of the Syrian National Council, the umbrella group representing the opposition to the regime of Syrian President Assad, confirms the Muslim Brotherhood affiliation of one of its members as first reported by the GMBDW in 2008. The SNC website, again, that's the Syrian National Council, the umbrella group representing the opposition to Syrian President Assad, the SNC website identified Bassem Hatahet as a member of its Muslim Brotherhood Alliance, unquote. Mr. Hatahet was identified as a leader of the Muslim Brotherhood in Belgium by a 2008 NEFA Foundation report. And in the printed description for this program, we have an analysis of the tactics of the Muslim Brotherhood in Belgium and elsewhere in Europe for infiltrating various institutions in civil society, and that is altogether instructive as we move from the links between Mr. Bassem Hatahet and the Autocto Milieu to his role in the ongoing covert operation against the President Bashar Assad. And we're going to be taking a look now at some of the terrifying things that have been going on with regard to nuclear facilities in Belgium. And then we are going to track back to taking a look at how ISIS and other Sunni jihadist groups have received support from the West for their ongoing role as proxy warriors against, among other things, or among other targets, the regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. Of Islamist and ISIS attempts apparently at penetrating and or attacking Belgian nuclear facilities. We read the following. This from the New York Times of March 25th of 2016. This is by Alyssa J. Rubin and Milan Schreuer, S-C-H-R-E-U-E-R. Belgium fears nuclear plants are vulnerable, and it reads in part as follows. The investigation into this week's deadly attacks in Brussels have prompted worries that the Islamic State is seeking to attack, infiltrate, or sabotage nuclear installations or obtain nuclear or radioactive material. This is especially worrying in a country with a history of security lapses at its nuclear facilities, a weak intelligence apparatus, and a deeply rooted terrorist network. On Friday, the authorities stripped security badges from civil workers at one of two plants where all non-essential employees had been sent home hours after the attacks at the Brussels airport and one of the city's busiest subway stations 3 days earlier. Video footage of a top official at another Belgian nuclear facility were discovered last year in the apartment of a suspected militant linked to the extremists who unleashed the horror in Paris in November, skipping down. The revelation of the video surveillance footage was the first evidence that the Islamic State has a focused interest in nuclear material. But Belgium's nuclear facilities have long had a worrying track record of breaches, prompting warnings from Washington and other foreign capitals. Some of these are relatively minor. The Belgian nuclear agency's computer system was hacked this year and shut down briefly. In 2013, two individuals managed to scale the fence at Belgium's research center in the city of Mol, that's M-O-L, break into a laboratory and steal equipment. Others are far more disconcerting. In 2012, two employees at the nuclear plant in Doel, D-O-E-L, quit to join jihadists in Syria and eventually transferred their allegiances to the Islamic State. Both men fought in a brigade that included dozens of Belgians, including Abdelhamid Abaoud, considered the on-the-ground leader of the Paris attacks. One of these men is believed to have died fighting in Syria, but the other was convicted of terror-related offenses in Belgium in 2014 and released from prison last year, according to Peter Van Ostaen, O-E-S-T-A-E-Y-E-N, a researcher who tracks Belgium's jihadist networks. It is not known whether they communicated information about their former workplace to their Islamic State comrades. At the same plant where these jihadists once worked, an individual who has yet to be identified walked into the reactor number 4 in 2014, turned a valve, and drained 65,000 liters of oil used to lubricate the turbines. The ensuing friction nearly overheated the machinery, forcing it to be shut down. The damage was so severe that the reactor was out of commission for 5 months, skipping down again. This was a deliberate act to take down the nuclear reactor and a very good way to do it, unquote, Mr. Berg, the nuclear agency spokesman, said of the episode in a recent interview, skipping down again. Three men linked to the surveillance video were involved in either the Paris or the Brussels attacks. Ibrahim and Khalid El-Bakrawi, the brothers who the authorities say were suicide bombers at the Brussels airport and subway station, are believed to have driven to the surveilled scientist's home and removed the camera that was hidden in nearby bushes. The authorities believe that they then took it to a house connected to Mohamed Bakali, B-A-K-K-A-L-I, who was arrested by the Belgian police after the Paris attacks and is accused of helping with logistics and planning. The police found the video camera during a raid on the house. Belgium has both low-enriched uranium, which fuels its two power plants, and highly enriched uranium, which is used in its research reactor, primarily to make medical isotopes, plus the byproducts of that process. The U.S. provides Belgium with highly enriched uranium, making it particularly concerned about radioactive materials landing in terrorist hands, and then buys isotopes. Experts say the most remote of the potential nuclear-related risks is that the Islamic State operatives would be able to obtain highly enriched uranium. Even the danger of a dirty bomb is limited, they said, because much radioactive waste is so toxic it would sicken or kill the people trying to steal it. What's not mentioned here, parenthetically, before we continue, but if you have a jihadist who is pledged to fight to the death and who sees dying in battle against the infidels as a surefire ticket to heaven, this would not be a deterring factor. So that's something to keep in mind. Skipping down again. While experts are doubtful the terrorists could steal the highly enriched uranium at the Mole reactor without alerting law enforcement, some nuclear scientists do believe that if they could obtain it, they could recruit people who know how to fashion a primitive nuclear device, skipping down again. The discovery of the surveillance video in November set off alarm bells across the small nuclear security community with fresh worries that terrorist groups could kidnap, extort, or otherwise coerce a nuclear scientist into helping them. The official whose family was watched works at Mole, one of 5 research reactors worldwide that produce 90% of the radioisotopes used for medical diagnosis and treatment. And again, that is more than a little interesting. Something else that is more than a little interesting right here. Security guards' murder fuels fears that nuclear plants in Belgium could be attacked. This by Tess Owen, O-W-E-N, of Vice News of March 26th of 2016. If what you read in that New York Times article didn't scare the fresh fertilizer out of you, perhaps this will. Halloween came early this year, I think. With Brussels still reeling in the aftermath of the deadly bombings this week, the murder of a nuclear power plant security guard and the theft of his badge has compounded fears that Belgium's 2 sprawling nuclear plants could be vulnerable to attacks. The security guard was found dead in his home in Charleroi, Charleroi. A post-industrial region known for its derelict factories and slag heaps. Didier Prospero, P-R-O-S-P-E-R-O, who worked for U.S.-owned security company G4S, was discovered shot dead in his bathroom on Thursday night. Belgian Bailey Dernier, D-E-R-N-I-E-R-E-H-E-U-R-E, reported that Prospero's children found him and that his dog had also been shot. His security pass was missing, but deactivated after his body was found, Dernier Hull said. And skipping down again, reviewing some material we have already looked at. And again, bear in mind that a security guard at one of Belgium's nuclear facilities was found shot dead. So was his dog. His security pass was missing. And skipping down again in this Vice News article from March 26th of this year. In February, Belgian authorities discovered 10 hours worth of secretly recorded video footage showing one of the country's top nuclear scientists coming and going from his home. The material was discovered during a counterterrorism raid on the home of Mohamed Bakali, who was arrested and charged with terrorism and murder associated with the November 13th Paris attacks. Ibrahim and Khalid El Bakrawi, brothers who authorities believe were the alleged suicide bombers at Brussels Airport and subway, are suspected to have planted the camera, which was hidden in bushes near the scientist's house. Experts and officials have contended that surveilling the nuclear official who had access to secure areas of a nuclear research facility in Mol was part of a grander scheme to take him hostage and force him to hand over radioactive material. DH reported on Thursday that the suicide bombers who self-detonated on Tuesday were originally planning an attack on nuclear facilities. However, as Belgian police started closing in on their extremist network and arrested suspected terrorists such as Salah, S-A-L-A-H, Abdeslam, A-B-D-E-S-L-A-M, DH said, militants were under pressure to carry out an attack as soon as possible and abandon the grander plan of targeting Belgium's nuclear infrastructure, skipping down. Until 2 years ago, security around Belgium's nuclear plants was fairly lax. In 2014, Belgian officials installed security cameras and developed a plan to combat cyber attacks. They also mandated that all employees move in groups to avoid sabotage by a lone wolf. Just 11 days before the attacks shook Brussels, Belgium's two nuclear facilities, which contain seven reactors, were guarded by unarmed security personnel. Well, that is more than a little disconcerting.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Now, what we're going to do is to take a look at the, well, binary, some might say incoherent or schizophrenic policy that the West has toward jihadist combatants. In many programs, among them, For the Record 790 and For the Record 830, I have set forth the corporatist economics of the Muslim Brotherhood and why jihadists are seen as valuable from an economic standpoint by the transnational corporations. In addition, they have long been used by elements of Western intel and before that by the fascist powers of Europe as proxy warriors on behalf of Islamic fascism, which at one point was fitted into the overall Axis agenda. The Muslim Brotherhood fought alongside of Nazi Germany and also was active to an extent in Asia. Then it jumped to the CIA and other Western intelligence services at the end of the war, and were used as anti-communist cadre in various places, culminating with the Afghan Mujahideen effort, which was then extended to the Balkans, and then to the Caucasus, where it continues to be used to this day. It also is now very much manifesting in Syria and elsewhere. The Boston Marathon bombing, among other incidents, appears to have been blowback from this schizophrenic Western policy of supporting Sunni jihadists and Muslim Brotherhood-derived jihadists as, again, proxy warriors initially against the Soviet Union, also against communist China, and also against the Balkans, now against Russia in the Caucasus, and also against places, against states like Syria. Again, thinking of World War II, where the major U.S. and other Western corporations were supportive of fascism as anti-communist or anti-labor warriors, and also because supplying them was very good business. The corporations actually were supportive of fascism, even as the armies of fascism were killing a great many Allied uniformed personnel. That is a good analogy because, once again, the utility of jihadists as proxy warriors on the one hand and the corporatist economics of the Muslim Brotherhood on another are manifesting again in support for jihadist elements. One of the major forges for ISIS has been the effort against Bashar al-Assad in Syria. This is from The Independent by Matt Broomfield. And one of the elements that is supporting the jihadists and also apparently exporting ISIS-linked terrorists to Europe, where the presence of those terrorists has been instrumental in winning favors and concessions from the European Union to Turkey. One of the major elements, according to King Abdullah of Jordan, in exporting ISIS combatants, ISIS terrorists to Europe, is Turkey and President Tayyip Erdogan. Again, from the London Independent of March 27th, 2016, article by Matt Broomfield. Turkey is deliberately unleashing ISIS terrorists into Europe, says Jordan's King Abdullah. Turkey is exporting ISIS-linked terrorists to Europe, according to King Abdullah of Jordan. The monarch's remarks came in a meeting with members of the U.S. Congress, in which he said that Islamist militants were being, quote, manufactured in Turkey, unquote, and unleashed, unquote, into Europe. He also used the debriefing held after a canceled rendezvous with U.S. President Barack Obama to remind the U.S. politicians of Turkey's alleged complicity in buying ISIS oil. The fact that the terrorists are going to Europe is part of official Turkish policy, said King Abdullah. Turkey keeps on getting a slap on the hand, but they are let off the hook, unquote. Arguing that the autocratic Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan believes in a radical Islamic solution to the region, unquote, King Abdullah said. Turkey sought a religious solution to Syria, while we are looking at moderate elements in the south, and Jordan pushed for a third option that would not allow a religious option. And skipping down again. And bear in mind that with the flood of refugees from the Syrian war and with the terrorist incidents there, and between those two dynamics, they are fueling political reaction in Europe. President Erdogan of Turkey has won some very generous concessions from the EU and Germany, and his draconian censorship of the press. Now he is basically instituting a centralized government that he favorably compared to the government of Adolf Hitler. And his latest move is to basically begin moving to charge all Kurdish members of the Turkish parliament as, quote, terrorists, unquote. There's essentially no difference between that and Hitler's Reichstag fire gambit. More about King Abdullah's accusations against Tayyip Erdogan. And again, King Abdullah of Jordan, a very moderate individual, has flat out accused Erdogan of deliberately exporting ISIS terrorists to Europe. Bear in mind that Turkey is a member of NATO and a collaborator with NATO and the U.S. against Russia and against Bashar al-Assad. It would be impossible, as we looked at in For the Record 884, among other programs, to exaggerate the extent to which my prognostications back in 2011 about Turkey and the utter nonsense about Turkey being a moderate Islamic democracy. I said it is none of those things. It is a Muslim Brotherhood, pan-Turkist, irredentist power, and Erdogan was a fascist. There have now been many articles and columns in, among other papers, today's Zaman, the English language version of Turkey's largest daily, saying just that. Erdogan is an Islamic fascist. The Middle East Eye of March 25th of 2016 have more about Erdogan and King Abdullah of Jordan's charge that he is deliberately exporting ISIS-linked terrorists to Europe. And King Abdullah also said that he is sending Islamists to Libya and Somalia as well. This again from Middle East Eye of March 25th of 2016. Jordan's king accuses Turkey of sending terrorists to Europe. Skipping down, this is by David Hurst, H-E-A-R-S-T. King Abdullah said that Erdogan believed in a, quote, radical Islamic solution to the region, unquote. He repeated, Turkey sought a religious solution to Syria, while we are looking at moderate elements in the south, and Jordan pushed for a third option that would not allow a religious option. The king presented Turkey as part of a strategic challenge to the world. We keep being forced to tackle problems against ISIL, the Islamic State group, but not the strategic issue. We forget the issue of the Turks, who are not with us on this strategically. He claimed that Turkey had not only supported religious groups in Syria and was letting foreign fighters in, but had also been helping Islamist militias in Libya and Somalia. And again, the King of Jordan flat out alleged that Erdogan was shipping terrorists to Europe. ISIS terrorists to Europe. And none of this appears, frankly, far-fetched. Again, the Islamic and pan-Turkist fascist nature of Erdogan and his government in Turkey is now really pretty much established. I would note again, and we're going to repeat some open statements by the chief of Turkish intelligence expressing sympathy for ISIS and rebuking the West for their rejection of ISIS. This from the AWD News blog of October 18th, 2015. Turkish intelligence chief, Putin's intervention in Syria is against Islam and international law. ISIS is a reality, and we are optimistic about the future, unquote. This, again, from the chief of Turkish intelligence, a guy named Hakan Fidan, F-I-D-A-N. Hakan Fidan, the head of Turkey's National Intelligence Organization, known by the MIT acronym, has drawn a lot of attention and criticism for his controversial comments about ISIS. Skipping down. Quote, ISIS is a reality, and we have to, we being Turkey and the West, and bear in mind Turkey is a NATO country, again, ISIS is a reality, and we have to accept that we cannot eradicate a well-organized and popular establishment such as the Islamic State. Therefore, I urge my Western colleagues to revise their mindset about Islamic political currents, put aside their cynical mentality, and thwart Vladimir Putin's plans to crush Syrian Islamist revolutionaries, unquote, and the Dolu news agency quoted Mr. Fidan as saying. Fidan further added that in order to deal with the vast number of foreign jihadists craving to travel to Syria, it is imperative that ISIS must set up a consulate or at least a political office in Istanbul. He underlined that it is Turkey's firm belief to provide medical care for all injured people fleeing Russian ruthless airstrikes, regardless of their political or religious affiliation. Skipping down. Emil Hokayem, a Washington-based Middle East analyst, said that Turkey's Erdogan and his oil-rich Arab allies have dual agendas in the war on terror, and as a matter of fact, are supplying the Islamic militants with weapons and money. Thus, Russian intervention is considered a devastating setback for their efforts to overthrow Syrian secular president Assad. And again, please note here that Turkey is a NATO country and is a collaborator with the U.S. It has won tremendous concessions from Europe, despite the fact that it is openly, the Erdogan government is openly cracking down on the free press there. The longtime foreign minister of Erdogan was forced to resign, and now Erdogan is pushing through a legal gambit that will enable him to charge the members of the Turkish parliament, particularly the Kurdish members, of being allied with, quote, terrorism, unquote, and therefore he can prosecute them. He's already doing that to editors and investigative reporters who have noted Turkey's open support for terrorism. The irony of Erdogan and his government charging members of the Turkish parliament and members of the Turkish journalistic community with being allied with terrorists, when in fact Erdogan and his intelligence chief and his government and his national security establishment are doing the same as a matter of course, is, frankly, a grotesque irony. Bear in mind again that King Abdullah of Jordan has flat out said that Erdogan is deliberately sending ISIS operatives, ISIS terrorists, to Europe, where their activities, again, in combination with the huge flood of refugees from the Syrian war, are basically winning tremendous concessions by the EU to Turkey.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Now, pivoting again to Syria and picking up something that we have spoken about in the past, not only the schizophrenic attitude of the West towards ISIS and ISIL, but the relatively, very shady, very indistinct dividing lines between exactly who is ISIS, who is al-Nusra Front, and some of the other groups, because again, on the battlefield, and in particular regions, various combatants have a tendency to switch allegiance. Many former Nusra Front fighters are now associated with ISIS. At the front, they often fight in tandem with one another. They are all offshoots, to one extent or another, of the Muslim Brotherhood. And again, many of them, such as al-Nusra Front and others, are affiliated with al-Qaeda. From the Consortium News blog of March 31st, 2016, is an article by Daniel Lazar, L-A-Z-A-R-E, How U.S.-Backed War on Syria Helped ISIS. Skipping down. So the U.S. and its allies helped the Islamic State by tying down Assad's forces in the north of Syria so that it could punch through in the center. But that's not all the U.S. did. It also helped ISIS by suspending bombings as the Islamic State neared the city of Palmyra, or Palmyra, P-A-L-M-Y-R-A. As the New York Times put it at the time, quote, "Any airstrikes against Islamic State militants in and around Palmyra would probably benefit the forces of President Bashar al-Assad. So far, the U.S.-led airstrikes in Syria have largely focused on areas far outside government control to avoid the perception of aiding a leader whose ouster President Obama has called for," unquote. Again, noting that basically U.S. airstrikes have been away from areas where jihadists have been actively fighting the Syrian government. And continuing with Daniel Lazar's analysis, the upshot was a clear message to ISIS to the effect that it had nothing to worry about from U.S. jet bombers as long as it engaged Assad's troops in close combat. The U.S. thus incentivized ISIS to press forward with the assault. Although residents later wondered why the U.S. had not bombed ISIS forces while they were traveling through miles of open desert roads, the answer simply is that Washington had other things on its mind. Rather than defeating ISIS, it preferred to use it to accomplish its primary goal, which was driving out Assad. And Lazar goes on, but what does this have to do with Brussels and Lahore? Simply that America's fundamental ambivalence toward ISIS, toward Al-Qaeda, and similar groups, its policy of battling them on one hand and seeking to make use of them on the other, is what allows Sunni terrorism to fester and grow. And still more of that, and pointing up a very interesting pointing out the timeline in which President Obama began ordering attacks against ISIS and the shifting of ISIS attention to terrorist attacks in Europe. This again from Consortium News of April 3rd of 2016. This is an article by Nauman, N-A-U-M-A-N, Sadiq, S-A-D-I-Q, Europe's Terror Blowback, unquote, and it reads in part as follows. The arrangement of an informal pact between the Western powers and the Sunni jihadists of the Middle East against the Shia Iranian axis worked well, at least for the Western powers and the Sunni jihadists, up to August of 2014, when the Obama administration made an about-face on its previous regime change policy in Syria and started conducting airstrikes against one group of Sunni jihadists battling against the Assad regime, the Islamic State. Again, this passage again for emphasis. This arrangement of an informal pact between the Western powers and the Sunni jihadists of the Middle East against the Shia Iranian axis worked well, at least for the Western powers and the Sunni jihadists, up to August of 2014, when the Obama administration made an about-face on its previous regime change policy in Syria and started conducting airstrikes against one group of Sunni jihadists battling against the Assad regime, the Islamic State. The Islamic State had transgressed the prescribed mission of regime change in Syria and overran Mosul and Anbar in Iraq. Again, this is really important to understand part of the schizophrenia here. The Islamic State had transgressed the prescribed mission of regime change in Syria and overran Mosul and Anbar in Iraq. The Islamic State also threatened the capital of another steadfast American ally, Massoud Barzani's Erbil in the oil-rich Iraqi Kurdistan, and began decapitating Western hostages. However, other Sunni jihadist forces such as Al-Qaeda's Nusra Front and its close ally, Arar al-Sham, continued to focus on ousting Assad and thus continued to receive Western weapons, including U.S.-made TOW missiles that were crucial for last year's successful offensive by the Saudi-backed Army of Conquest in Syria's Idlib IDLIB province. After the West's 2014 shift in the Syrian strategy, bombing Islamic State forces both in Iraq and Syria, and the Russian military intervention in 2015 on the side of Syria's Alawite Shia regime, the momentum of Sunni jihadist expansion in Syria stalled. Many now feel that their Western allies betrayed the Sunni jihadist cause, engendering bitterness and a desire for revenge. And by the way, parenthetically, something very similar happened when the U.S. entered the war on the side of the Allies, World War II, that is. The fascist powers of Asia and Europe were not only obviously committed in a political and military sense against the U.S., but they felt particularly betrayed because they felt that their anti-Soviet, anti-labor, anti-communist, and pro-corporatist stance should have endeared them to the U.S. It did indeed endear them to major elements of corporate America and their allied political elites. So this is, again, a very good, albeit imperfect, analogy between the schizophrenic attitude of the West, the U.S. in particular, toward the Sunni jihadists, including Islamic State, and the fact, again, that they are fighting an element that they also support in different areas at different times. And this is just Islamic State. Elements like the Al-Qaeda Nusra Front and others continue to enjoy Western support. Now look at the time frame here. Again, returning to the Consortium News article by Nauman Sadiq from April 3rd of 2016, Europe's Terror Blowback. If we look at the chain of events, the timing of Paris and Brussels attacks is critical. The Islamic State overran Mosul in Iraq in June of 2014. The Obama administration started bombing Islamic State's targets in Iraq and Syria in August of 2014. Again, Islamic State overruns Mosul in Iraq in June of 2014. In August, the Obama administration started bombing Islamic State's targets in Iraq and Syria. And the first Islamic State incident of terrorism on Western soil took place at the offices of Charlie Hebdo in January of 2015, followed by the November 2015 Paris attacks and the March 2016 Paris bombings. So again, June of 2014, the Islamic State exceeds its directive, which is to work against Bashar al-Assad in Syria. They overrun Mosul in Iraq. That's in June of 2014. In August, Obama orders attacks on Islamic State in both Iraq and Syria. That is in August of 2014. The Charlie Hebdo offices get attacked in Paris in January of 2015, followed by the November 2015 Paris attacks and the March 2016 Brussels bombings. And still more among the various places where the West is still supporting some of those same Sunni jihadist concerns. Yemen, where Saudi Arabia is backing jihadists, Sunni jihadists, against the Houthi H-O-U-T-H-I rebels. And that's not all. Again, from Consortium News of May 7th of 2016, also by Daniel Lazar, L-A-Z-A-R-E, The Secret Behind the Yemen War, skipping down. Washington still tilted toward Islamic State when it came to combating Syrian government forces, which is why it refrained from bombing ISIS fighters as they converged on Palmyra in May of 2015, even though they would have been perfect targets as they traversed miles of open desert. But it otherwise tilted toward the al-Nusra Front, as al-Qaeda is locally known, which is now regarded as less dangerous, or toward groups with which al-Nusra is closely aligned. Quote, moderate these days is increasingly becoming anyone who's not affiliated with ISIL, unquote. Director of National Intelligence James R. Clapper explained in March of 2015. And indeed, the White House made no objection a month later when so-called moderates joined with al-Nusra, again, an al-Qaeda front organization, to launch a major offensive in Syria's northern Idlib province. So again, I can appreciate that a lot of this seems really bizarre. Wait a minute, aren't we fighting against ISIS? Well, that depends on what and depends on where and when, really. And the fact of the matter is, again, I think it is a valid analogy that the ambivalent attitude on the part of Western countries toward the Axis combatants of World War II. On the one hand, they fought them because the Axis had their own agenda. Germany and Japan had in mind conquering the world, and Italy the same, albeit to a lesser extent. So in a sense, the U.S. in particular, as well as other countries, wound up fighting a Frankenstein's monster that they had helped to create. Something very similar is happening with the jihadist slash Muslim Brotherhood elements in the Middle East and elsewhere, where jihad has been seen as a vehicle for installing corporatist economics and for mobilizing proxy warriors against Russia or against Bashar al-Assad or perhaps Iran. It was used in the Balkans. It is being used in the Caucasus. And unfortunately, this tragic duality continues, even as some of these same jihadist forces are killing U.S. and Western military personnel. I also would note that, as usual, the so-called progressive sector in this country is completely missing the boat on this. And it almost goes without saying, so is the conspiracy crowd. They're either maintaining, well, this is all, it was all false flag operations or this and that. It is much more complicated than that, which is, and none of these elements have paid attention to the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th, 2002. The Wall Street Journal of April 18th of 2002 on page A4 had a full-page article about how Talat Atman, a political advisor and personal friend of both Georges Bush, a member of the board of directors of Harkin Energy, which grew out of Arbusto Energy, and the man who gave an Islamic benediction at the Republican convention in 2000, interceded directly on behalf of the individuals and institutions who had been busted for financing international terrorism, including al-Qaeda. That was then completely covered up. The conspiracy crowd, well, they get just about everything wrong, just about always now with their nonsense about a controlled demolition or this and that. That actually works to cover up the very dynamic we're looking at here. Because if you're talking about, oh, it was an inside job, it was a controlled demolition, well, talking about 9/11 or any of these other incidents as an inside job is rather like, it's the wrong frame of reference. It's like asking how many miles are there between 9 o'clock and midnight. There is, in fact, profound Western complicity in the operations of these terrorist organizations, but they're quite content to have this blowback take place. It actually works to drive political reaction, as we have seen. But it's not a false flag operation. It's much more complex and really much more sinister. And then you've got the so-called progressive sector who can't think at all for the most part and who are possessed with what is frankly an Orientalist point of view. When they look at the Arab and Muslim world at a preconscious level, they imagine Aladdin sailing in the front door on a magic carpet and rubbing his magic lamp, and out comes Scheherazade doing a goddamn belly dance. I mean, that's the level on which they operate. They look at the Arab and Muslim world and they say, oh yes, our beautiful brown-skinned Muslim brothers and sisters, they are so quaint with their beards and their hijabs, but we do love them. So they have no understanding of what they're looking at. And really, they can't effectively think this is all oppression of Muslims. Well, it's much more complicated than that, and that sort of dingbat attitude, frankly, will not solve anything. This concludes, for the record, 910, The Killer Bees, the Belgian Muslim Brotherhood and the Brussels Bombings, subtitled The ISIS File, Part 2, being recorded on May 22nd of 2016. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.